Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Mike Haggerty, in today for Vicky Gonzalez. 2 months ago, while on his statewide tour identifying his priorities for his second term, California Governor Gavin Newsom announced plans to convert San Quentin State Prison into a rehabilitation facility. The famous prison, tucked along the coastline of Marin County, is California's oldest. It was built back in the mid-1800s. And just like the prison itself, Governor Newsom says the model of incarceration in California is outdated and not serving the inmates or the community well anymore.
Two-thirds of folks, Senator says, coming out of the prison every single year, or at least within 3 years, violate some probation order or commit another damn crime. I mean, two-thirds, and we perpetuate that system, and we call that system somehow public safety-oriented? Where's the public safety in that? It's exactly as Miyabanta said. This is about asking ourselves the fundamental question, what are the community's needs? How do we serve the community? Knowing that 30,000 people every single year come out of our system, 30,000 through CDCR every single year, 804 of you came out of this system last year just in San Quentin, 50 to 80 people every single month cycling back out into the community. That's reality. And how are people coming back? Are they ready to reintegrate in society? They're ready to be fully participatory in the life of their city and their county, our state and our nation? Or are they bitter? And so for us, this is about real public safety. This is about keeping communities safe. This is about getting serious about addressing the issue of crime and violence in our state.
That was Governor Newsom during his press conference back on March 17th at San Quentin, where he said he wants the prison to operate like similar facilities in Scandinavia, though the governor is quick to say he prefers to call it the California model. And last week, the governor announced Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg as his choice to lead the San Quentin Transformation Advisory Council. I talked with Mayor Steinberg about that yesterday, along with a couple of other hot-button issues. Mayor, it's good to talk with you.
Always good to talk to you, Mike.
You've had a varied career in public service, city council in the 1990s, the assembly, the Senate, where you rose to president pro tem, and for the past 6.5 years, mayor of Sacramento. You have a well-deserved reputation as an advocate for better mental health care. Incarceration and rehabilitation seems like a slightly different path. So what makes you the right person to lead this advisory group?
Well, actually, there are a lot of similarities between the evolution of the mental health system and what the governor is calling on and for in the transformation of San Quentin Prison and the new California model for how we deal with public safety. And here is the connection. 40 years ago, I've said it often, more than 40 years ago, the state made a decision to shut the state mental hospitals and promised a decent system of community-based care and treatment for people. And it's a promise that despite the Mental Health Services Act and a lot of other important efforts, it's a promise that has largely gone unfulfilled. And you know what has been the number one substitute for the closed mental health hospitals, unfortunately? It's the state prisons, where people serve their sentences. And by the way, 90% of the people who go to state prison are eventually going to be released into society. Those 90% largely are not getting the kind of employment skills, education, mental health rehabilitation, whatever it takes to enable them to have a much greater chance of success when they are eventually released from prison. And that's the essence of the governor's vision here. Public safety first. Public safety is increased and enhanced if we do a better job of helping people prepare for their eventual release so that they can go back into society without committing more crimes and instead being productive members of the society. That's the opportunity here. So it's very much aligned with the work I've done in the mental health area for decades. And I'm very excited about it and honored that the governor asked me to be a big part of this. Now, of course, I'm not the only one. There is a nationally recognized advisory council of experts, who have seen the best practices throughout not just the country and the world about how to be innovative around public safety. And it includes victims of crime advocates. It includes leading academics. It includes people who have been involved in the current system, know its strengths, but also know its flaws. And I'm very excited about working with a number of nationally recognized experts to make San Quentin not the beginning of the transformation in California, but to make it the symbol of and the beginning of implementing the California model throughout the entire state.
You mentioned people who've been involved. Does this include formerly incarcerated people? Will any of those people be on that?
It sure does. The lived experience of people who have been released and who have succeeded, because we don't start from scratch, by the way. San Quentin, for example, has some already nationally recognized education programs and initiatives to help people who are eventually going to leave succeed once they leave. But we need to enhance those approaches. We need to scale those approaches. We need to add some elements that we haven't yet implemented or even thought of. And, you know, we don't do this in isolation. Norway has a international reputation for how to enhance public safety, but do so in a way that is centered on helping the individual return to society and become productive and safe members of society. You know, you just look at the recidivism rates. In California, for a period ending about 2017-18, what we found is that about 45% of people who leave prison commit another offense. In Norway, it's 25%. And that is because they have scaled the idea of wrapping themselves around the individual who is going to be released and making sure that they have the education, that they have the employment skills, that they have the mental health and or substance abuse rehabilitation that they need in order to succeed. Public safety is enhanced when we do everything to make sure that people who are leaving have a much better chance of success. And that's what the California model is about. And that's what this San Quentin opportunity is about. I'm very excited about it.
San Quentin is currently at 130% of design capacity, with prisons in general at 110% of design capacity. San Quentin was effectively closed for programs for years due to COVID. It lagged significantly behind the reopening of broader society. Some incarcerated people have suggested that the prison, San Quentin, and for that matter, any prison, can't really have a focus on rehabilitation until it deals with overcrowding. What do you think about that?
Well, there's a unique opportunity at San Quentin, and that is the closing of Death Row and the vacant Prison Industry Authority warehouse. These are two significant physical plant opportunities that the governor and the advisory council have to be able to reimagine and remake San Quentin as a rehabilitation center. And so in some ways, San Quentin is perfect. It's also its location, its central location to a number of job centers, and also a lot of people who have volunteered their time and their efforts for years to enhance these programs at San Quentin. It's a perfect laboratory to demonstrate that a new model, a California model, can actually be the way we go about enhancing public safety in the right way in California. And besides, San Quentin is iconic, and it's internationally known. And so to choose a place that has been the symbol of traditional forms of incarceration and to show that it can be transformed into a genuine rehabilitation center while preserving public safety, it's way too good of an opportunity to start anywhere else.
Obviously, we're discussing a transformation and not a fine-tuning, but are there things that San Quentin is doing right currently that could be incorporated into the new model?
Absolutely. As I said, San Quentin, with their media center, for example, with some of their cutting-edge education programs, there's a great new film out about San Quentin's running club, training people who are incarcerated to become marathon runners as a way to learn different discipline and life skills. San Quentin is already doing a lot of good and great work, but the governor wants to enhance that. The governor wants to scale it. The governor wants to add to it. And the governor wants to change the nature of the prison itself from a prison to a rehabilitation center. Now, that's not soft on crime, just the opposite. It's recognizing that 90% of the people are going to re-enter society. And with a 45% recidivism rate, are we going to change in a way that significantly reduces that number so that the people leaving succeed and so that the public is safer? That's what's golden about the months and the short years ahead, because the governor wants this launched by 2025. So this is not some, you know, multi-decade vision. It may take some time to transform the entire system and to spread the California model throughout all of the prisons in California. But this is sure an aggressive and a good start.
Clearly, there's a lot of work there, and you also have a big job as mayor of Sacramento. How are you planning to balance those demands?
Well, like I said, in some ways, there is a consistency between some of the extracurricular work I volunteer for and a mayorship, because we're living here in the city, just as so many major cities in California are, the consequences of a failed system, the consequences of shutting those state mental hospitals decades ago and never following through until this governor, by the way, because he's made mental health a major priority as well and is backing it with real money on top of my work back in 2004 with the Mental Health Services Act. In many ways, it's a promise still unfulfilled, and we're living the consequences of it, right? Which is increasing homelessness, the tent encampments. And so the more that I can do, given my history, to help impact state policy in a positive direction, the better it will be for my city. And I, even though I'm a little older than when I started 3 decades ago, I still have a lot of energy and can juggle a few balls at the same time, especially if it's all the same theme, which it is.
Speaking of Sacramento, the city's Compensation Commission recently approved raises for you and the council, 3.5%. It is the latest in a series of yearly increases. What do you say to those who believe that the rank and file city employees aren't nearly keeping pace?
Well, we're in the middle of, or I should say at the beginning of negotiations with all of our employees. And last night at the city council, we set aside virtually all of our city surplus to put on the bargaining table and to make sure that we treat all of our employees in the way that they deserve and that respects their service and the public service. And so we're going to work very closely with our unions and the rank and file to increase their salaries. You know, in terms of my salary, it's an independent commission. And so, as I always say with independent commissions, you live, you smile if they give you a modest increase, and you smile if they go the other way, because that's independent.
Speaking of your job as mayor, you have said several times recently that you're still deciding on whether you're going to run for a third term and that a decision would come soon. I don't suppose that I could persuade you that right now is soon.
I don't think today is the day, but I do plan within a short couple of weeks to announce my intentions, and I will leave it at that. I love the role of mayor. It has been a great honor to serve in this capacity, like it has been an honor to serve as senator and assembly member and council member and pro tem. And to me, service is service. And so I'm deciding for myself, not so much politically, but personally, what I want to do in the next chapter of my life. And stay tuned. I'll announce soon.
There are a couple of candidates already in the race. Any thoughts on those two women, Flo Jen Kofer and Maggie Krell?
Well, I think they're both fine people, fine leaders. And, you know, I admire anybody, especially in this day and age, who is willing to jump into the fray and put themselves out there. But we'll see. I haven't made an announcement yet. So,
Mayor Daryl Steinberg, we really appreciate your taking the time to talk with us. Thank you.
Enjoyed it very much, Mike. Thank you.
That was my conversation with Mayor Daryl Steinberg. We talked yesterday afternoon. Up next, we'll learn how the town of Paradise collaborated on a new study revealing how communities across California can reduce their fire risk and cut insurance costs. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Mike Haggerty for Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Mike Haggerty, and today for Vicki Gonzalez. Despite a winter which exceeded all expectations, California remains the state with the most property at risk of damage due to wildfires. According to analytic firm CoreLogic, more than 1.2 million single-family homes across the state remain vulnerable, and roughly 11 million people reside in what's known as the Wildland Urban Interface, or WUI, where the threat is the greatest. Since 2017, 8 of the 10 largest wildfires in state history have ignited, scorching more than 11 million acres and destroying at least 50,000 structures. That's led to higher premiums, less coverage, or policyholders who live and work in the WUI losing coverage entirely. But a new study released this spring is suggesting that there's a path forward for homeowners and communities in wildfire-prone areas to safely build homes and to do so affordably. The study was funded by the Bay Area Council in partnership with the town of Paradise, the epicenter of the 2018 campfire, which destroyed more than 18,000 structures and claimed the lives of at least 85 people in Butte County. Joining us now to tell us more about the study and how it aims to help communities facing the greatest risk of wildfires is Colette Curtis, Recovery and Economic Development Director for the Town of Paradise, and Adrian Covert, Senior Vice President of Public Policy with the Bay Area Council. Colette and Adrian, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So,
thanks for having us.
We're happy you're here. Can you tell us, Adrian, more about what the Bay Area Council is and what you hope to accomplish by producing this study?
Sure, happy to. So the Bay Area Council is a business-backed public policy research and advocacy group located in San Francisco. And we traditionally focus on Bay Area-related public policy issues like housing and transportation and all that. But you know, really starting a few years ago, we started focusing much more on climate change and climate impacts particularly following the wildfires in Sonoma County in 2017 in the area around where I live in Santa Rosa. And we realized that to increase the resilience of the Bay Area, you need to build resilience throughout the state. We're all connected. We in the Bay Area, we were getting choked with smoke from fires burning hundreds of miles away. We import our water from many places hundreds of miles away. Every region in California is connected to other regions. And so we're really taking a statewide approach to this. So we funded this research through our statewide California Resilience Challenge initiative because we felt it was a really innovative way at examining the wildfire risks in the urban and wildland interface communities and trying to find ways to make sure that they can grow and prosper and become more safer, strengthen their resilience to wildfire in future years.
Can you tell me more about the California Resilience Challenge?
You're happy to. It's a statewide philanthropic initiative funded by businesses and utilities to put out and invite under-resourced communities to apply for early stage climate adaptation planning grants. The thing is that virtually every community in California is facing some sort of climate risk, wildfire, heat, drought, flooding. But many of these communities don't have the resources to begin planning the types of changes needed to protect their homes, residents, and businesses. So we, with support from funders like JP Morgan Chase and PG&E and Edison and Valley Water and others, created this fund to help communities get there. And that's what we were happy to provide support to the town of Paradise for.
Colette, how did Paradise become a participant in the study, and why did you and others in the community believe that it was important to take a central role in it?
Absolutely. Well, I think that the Camp Fire, of course, the size and scope of that disaster really lends itself to study and looking to see how we can learn from something like this to help other communities. And, you know, recovery from something like this is really a series of obstacles and then successes. And then from those successes, you can learn and hopefully share that with others. And so one of those obstacles or barriers that we're facing right now really has to do with insurance. And that's kind of a big portion of what this study talks about is how to build and exist in a more resilient way, not only to be safer, but to make sure that insurance is available for those in our community and other communities who also live in the wildland urban interface or WUI. So that was kind of how this study came about and why this relationship began.
You've been in your current role as Recovery and Economic Development Director since July of 2021. What motivated you to take on the role, and how has it been challenging and rewarding?
Oh, goodness, it's so rewarding. And I've worked for the town of Paradise for 10 years. So I was here before the fire, during and after. And then, of course, after the fire, we realized we really needed to consolidate our recovery activities in a department. So we formed a department that that I oversee, that oversees recovery as well as economic development, because those two things are very tied together. And of course, this role is extremely challenging. Recovery, like I said, is a series of obstacles, but those obstacles become successes. And that's where that rewarding part comes. You know, there have been many obstacles since the fire. We continue to overcome them and learn from those. And it is our responsibility and our joy to be able to share what we have with other communities to help them prepare. Hopefully they will never experience something like we have, but if they do, we want to be there to help them prepare and also help them in the aftermath on how to recover.
The fifth anniversary of the Camp Fire is this November. What can you share with our listeners about how your town is doing, and what would you like them to know about the community's ongoing recovery?
We are doing very well. So again, this was a very large disaster. We knew from the outset this was going to be a decades-long recovery, but we are recovering at a pace that is really encouraging to us and is outpacing what we expected. We did, of course, reach out to other communities that have experienced major disasters to understand what we might expect. And we are, again, very encouraged by the pace of rebuilding and restoring of our infrastructure that we have seen thus far. And that comes with many, many partners and support. Those other communities that experienced disaster have been instrumental, such as Santa Rosa, even Louisiana after Katrina. They have informed us in our recovery, as well as our federal and state recovery partners who have assisted us with the financial aspects of recovery. But at this point, we have restored about 25% of our housing that was lost during the fire. So we feel very good about that. We still have a long way to go. This is, again, a decades-long recovery, but we are very pleased at the recovery that we have had so far.
Circling back to the study, Adrian, what are the biggest headlines from the study, and why are they important?
Great question. So the main takeaway is that communities in the wildland-urban interface can be made much safer and more resilient than they are today, and those actions needed to strengthen the safety of these communities can be quantified by insurers in a way that leads to actually reduced insurance premiums, which is essential for the prolonged health and vitality of these communities. And at the top of the show, you mentioned, one in four homes in California is in the urban wildland interface. It's becoming increasingly difficult for homeowners in those communities to keep and afford insurance. This is a big issue, not just for the town of Paradise, but for many millions of Californians. So this report specifically says that quantifies how several specific actions communities can take, including programs to incentivize homeowners to defend their properties better with vegetation management, and wildfire-informed development patterns is what we're calling it, which is essentially involves incorporating external buffer areas and internal buffer areas, separating your community from high-risk wildfire zones. Essentially, this means well-maintained open spaces in between your community and a forested area or a wildland area. You want it well-maintained with few tree limbs low to the ground, not a lot of vegetation density. It could be gravel, it could be grass, it could turn it into a park, but a well-maintained open space between the community and a wildfire at-risk area, and also utilizing open spaces that are already within the community. And then focusing your growth, or if a fire has already occurred, your reconstruction, in low-risk areas, such as a downtown, more walkable communities, and some added gentle density, can go a long way. We estimate that in the town of Paradise alone, if all of these actions were implemented, they could reduce wildfire risk by 71%, which could translate to insurance premiums being cut by as much as 55%. That's just in the town of Paradise, but the implications are clear for those other 11 million residents and 1 million homes throughout the state.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that this is not a study that's an academic exercise done with data points. You're working in a community that's still recovering from trauma and devastation. How do you carry out the study effectively while also being sensitive and respectful to the people of Paradise who are rebuilding their lives and community?
That's a great question. Colette might want to weigh in on this as well, but I know the community, the folks who actually conducted the study at CoreLogic and Milliman worked hand in glove with the city, and they had some outreach there to speak with them on the ground. So Colette, do you want to weigh in on any of that, on the actual execution?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really important question because in recovery, of course, when it's something like a very large disaster, there is a lot of trauma involved. And you have to keep that in mind in everything that you're doing when you're working with residents and coming up with policy, because you have to balance doing everything you can to keep the community safe with, the perception of safety and dealing with the trauma that just is inherent in the residents there. So I will say that those that were carrying out the study did an excellent job with that and working with the town and with our residents. This is something that our residents are very supportive of. They coming up with looking for solutions for insurance. It is a major issue for those who are trying to rebuild and come back home. And so this is something that is badly needed. And I think it's also really important to note that this is not just an academic study. This is something that we are putting into practice every single day. So these concepts that are discussed in this study are things that, have kind of been in our minds for a long time. And this was such an excellent opportunity to put this down into a study with really great scientific backed data to show how these things can reduce risk. And we are putting them into effect as we speak. So the things that Adrian just talked about, we actually have required those now of our building standards. So some of that defensible space, having a non-combustible zone around your home, 5 feet from your home, that is a required part of rebuilding when you rebuild your home or build your home in the town of Paradise. So we are requiring those aspects as well as working with our parks department on buffer zones as well. So we are implementing these and seeing a lot of excitement in the community around these efforts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We're speaking with Colette Curtis with the Town of Paradise and Adrian Covert from the Bay Area Council about a study they partnered on revealing how homeowners can reduce wildfire risk and insurance costs. Adrian, two of the biggest findings from the study were that homeowners and the communities can reduce their losses from a wildfire by up to 75% and cut their insurance costs by more than half. How were you and the organizations you partnered with for the study able to quantify those estimates?
Good question. CoreLogic and Milliman are two wild insurance actuaries that did the bulk of the analysis for this. They're able to take a look at science that's been done on wildfire risk and flammability, and put those things together in ways to come up with actual estimates that can influence the market. So I'm not an expert specifically in that part of the insurance estimation, but I was pleased to work with them over the past few months to get the analysis ready. But that's really a question for them.
The study outlines some limitations, one of those being the specific notation that the conclusions are limited to the scope of work specified by the Town of Paradise. For people who are living in different communities, what should they keep in mind before they try to apply some of the findings of this study?
Well, I think the important thing here is that the analysis was conducted for the Town of Paradise, but the study's authors were very clear that the implications are easily transferable to other communities that are in similar situations as the Town of Paradise. So the specific numbers, reducing risk to buildings and structures by 75% if all of these mitigation actions were taken, the translation of those into a 55% insurance premium reduction, that is for the Town of Paradise. But it gives you a window, a glimpse of the orders of magnitude of savings and impact that these actions could have in communities that are facing similar threats as the Town of Paradise.
Over the last decade, many Californians have seen their insurance coverage reduced, premiums increased, or policies canceled outright by their insurance companies due to the threat of wildfires. Have any notable insurance companies or industry groups responded to this study's findings?
Not that I'm aware of. But we are still in the early stages of getting this story out there. So being on this radio show this morning helps with that message. So thanks.
There has been some debate in light of the alarming increase of larger and more destructive wildfires over the last decade, with some people arguing that expanding communities or building new ones in areas where the risk of wildfire is highest should be slowed or halted entirely. You believe this study provides a blueprint for how communities can safely and affordably grow despite the threat. So what do you say to people who may not share your optimism?
You know, I just think that we can't afford to abandon communities that are in these communities that are at risk. There's too many of them in the state, and they're too important for the state's economic future. And the folks who have said that we can't build or we can't grow, we got to move people, they need to provide some data to back it up, because our numbers here that we've shown clearly demonstrate from the folks who would actually be on the hook for paying for reconstruction, the insurance companies, now have confidence that if certain measures are taken, you can make these communities much safer and much more insurable.
And, cool. And I'd like to add to that, if I may.
Sure.
I think that's a really great point that Adrian made, that the study really shows how you can build and live in these types of communities in a safer, more resilient way. But I think the larger question too is, I think it would be very difficult for us as a society to find a place to live that really has no hazards that could happen, whether it be hurricanes or floods or tornadoes. You know, there are hazards inherent in living in this state, in this country. And so I think that we, you know, what we have to do is do some of the analysis that has been done in the study for every type of hazard community to find how we can live in these areas in a more resilient way so that we can move forward.
And Colette, clearly your community has been the hardest hit. What's been the response from people in Paradise to the study?
You know, there's been a lot of excitement about this because, again, right now, insurance is a major barrier for people who are rebuilding, whether they have already rebuilt and are now finding their insurance, them being dropped from their insurance, or whether they are trying to rebuild and are unable to find insurance for an affordable price. And so something, you know, every step that we can take to try to get more insurability in our community is very supported by our residents.
Colette Curtis is Recovery and Economic Development Director for the Town of Paradise. Adrian Covert, Senior Vice President of Public Policy with the Bay Area Council. And we've been talking about their study revealing how communities facing the greatest risk of wildfires can reduce fire risk and insurance costs. Thank you both for talking with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Still ahead, North State Public Radio's Nancy Wigman shares her conversation with NPR's Steve Drummond about his new book, The Watchdog, a chronicle of Harry Truman's rise from obscure senator to the White House. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Mike Haggerty, and for Vicki Gonzalez, and we're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Mike Haggerty, and for Vicki Gonzalez. World War II began with Germany's invasion of Poland in 1939. It was just the start, and as war swept Europe, it was inevitable the United States would be pulled into the fighting. The U.S. was unprepared for battle. It would have to ramp up every industry before entering the war. With billions of dollars spent on production efforts, it was likely that corruption and greed would take some slice of the defense production pie. At the time, an unknown United States senator from Missouri took it upon himself to create the Truman Committee to investigate corruption and overspending in the defense effort. That committee helped identify waste and create efficiency to advance a weak military into arguably the most powerful the world had seen at that point. This fascinating history is detailed in NPR News executive producer Steve Drummond's new book, The Watchdog: How the Truman Committee Battled Corruption and Helped Win World War II. Nancy Wigman, host of Nancy's Bookshelf, which airs on our sister station, North State Public Radio, joins us now to talk about the book and the interview with Steve Drummond. Thanks for joining us, Nancy.
Good morning, Mike. Nice to be with you.
Great to have you here. For our listeners who may not know Steve Drummond, can you tell us a little bit about his background as a journalist, educator, and his work with NPR?
Yeah, because even us loyal fans of NPR wouldn't be familiar with the name Steve Drummond, I don't think, because he was he is executive producer and he's won awards. He was a newspaper reporter, and he also teaches journalism at the University of Maryland.
So, yeah, unless you're a credits freak, and some of us are, listening very carefully for those credits for executive producer, we might not know Steve. His new book is The Watchdog: How the Truman Committee Battled Corruption and Helped Win World War II. As the title suggests, Steve is focusing on Harry Truman's time running the Special Senate Defense Committee before he became vice president and then later president. How did Steve land on this largely overlooked part of Truman's history?
Well, I mentioned he had been a newspaper reporter. He also wrote for magazines, and he was working on a magazine article about Detroit during World War II, and he actually uses the word stumbled. He stumbled on this committee that Harry Truman chaired, and he got so interested in it, he wrote this book about the Truman Committee.
So, in Truman's youth, he was a first lieutenant during World War I. How does the novel describe Truman in that war?
Now, I was impressed by that because I didn't know that the men could elect their leaders during World War II. He was in the National Guard. And that told me that, well, people who worked with him recognized his leadership qualities because they elected, he thought, oh, maybe I'll get elected sergeant, but they elected him first lieutenant. And so that I was impressed by the fact that his own men recognize his leadership qualities.
Yeah,
in
that's very different from being kicked up the ladder by the bigwigs.
Yes, I thought so too.
And I misspoke a moment ago. I said novel. It's a work of history, not fiction. Are there insights into how his experience in World War I would influence his work and leadership on the committee 20 years later?
Well, he recognized the fact that after World War I, they set up investigations to study how waste had occurred. And so Truman recognized that's not when you need the investigation. You need them at the start when we're gearing up for war. And so that's why Truman decided to put together this committee.
You had the conversation with Steve. That we had a very small fighting force prior to World War II, didn't we?
Yeah, that was one of the things that astounded me when I read the statistics that at the start of the war and how we were able to gear up and start producing what we did. The, for example, in the Ford Motor Company, they hired 30,000 workers. Where are you going to house 30,000 workers? How are they going to get to work? And then the assembly line was a mile long. That's these figures just were amazing, and I really enjoyed the research that Steve Drummond put into this book. A tremendous amount of research. He read letters, and I think women would appreciate the fact that he was very respectful of his wife Bess, and a lot of what we know is because he wrote letters regularly to Bess.
You know, one of the things that you and Steve Drummond say you were surprised by, and so was I, was just how small the United States military was before World War II and the tall order the Truman Committee faced. This is Steve Drummond talking to you about just how small the U.S. military was when World War II broke out and what the task in front of the Truman Committee was.
War broke out initially in 1939, 2 years before the United States would get into the war. The United States Army was ranked in size 17th in the world behind Romania. Everyone knew the United States would have to get ready and get ready real fast. And in all of that spending, what Truman realized was some of that money was going to get wasted. Some of it was going to end up in the pockets of big companies, or some of it would just get lost through inefficiency or mismanagement. And that's what the Truman Committee set out to correct.
The 17th largest military in the world. That was the United States in 1939. That's a stunning statistic.
Well, you know, I can understand why people have just gone through a war and they don't want to even contemplate another war. So I could see how people wouldn't want to put money into building up war materials and soldiers. So you know, I think that's kind of understandable.
Well, yeah, and World War I was, as our grandparents called it, the war to end all wars. It didn't work out that
yes.
way, but that was what
yes.
they were hoping. You know, I think we've all, Nancy, gotten considerably more jaded about politicians in the past 75 years, but Truman was serious and sincere about rooting out wasteful spending and ensuring government spending was efficient, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was. And I thought it was interesting. He talked about going, he went personally to these places, and he went to, for example, Fort Leonard Wood, and he saw millions of dollars being squandered. There are just hundreds of men just doing nothing but collecting a paycheck. And he exposed this. He had a staff, he had a chief counsel on his staff, Hugh Fulton was his name, and wrote letters, and thousands of letters out. And so I think Truman also showed his respect for us ordinary citizens by wanting to include us in his work.
You know, I think the cynics would look at a situation like this and say, well, you know, the investigation will cost more than the problem that it's that it's being created to look into. But Truman actually, he hired young staffers straight out of college. That kept the payroll low for the committee. And some people would describe Harry Truman personally as frugal. What was media and public opinion about Truman like at the time that he was running the committee?
Well, before that, he just wasn't even on their radar screen. They didn't pay any attention to this politician named Harry Truman until he started exposing what was really going on. And the media then started paying attention. And he was, I think, unprepared for all the media attention that he got because of what he was uncovering.
You know, presidents are usually the ones who either take credit for a successful war effort or responsibility for a failed one. In this case, the president was Franklin D. Roosevelt. But the Truman Committee clearly had an effect on the ability of American troops to win World War II, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he did. And I was impressed, too, that he was more concerned with the principles of their office rather than his own self-interest. And I appreciated that.
And part of Truman's, you know, you think about trying to control waste, and sometimes the baby gets thrown out with the bathwater. It just yeah. becomes slash spending. But the Truman Committee, in fact, was able to spot places where we simply didn't have enough material. U-boats were taking tremendous tolls.
Oh, my goodness. That was another thing that astounded me. I had no idea the destruction that German U-boats caused at the start of the war.
They were sinking our boats faster than we can build them. And it was really the Truman Committee that identified that because the Pentagon was trying to keep it quiet and you know, said we need to spend this money.
Yeah. And then how do you solve that problem? And a lot of the suggestions were other boats in the water. And I thought it was interesting that somebody said, hey, well, what about helicopters to combat this problem of German U-boats? And there was Igor Sikorsky.
And that, there you are, one of the essential tools of modern warfare. You know, we often focus on wartime presidents and generals, but we often forget the people, the factory workers, the construction workers that ramp up production. How does this book connect our individual family stories? And what do you hope people remember from The Watchdog?
Well, it encouraged me to want to find out more about just those of people I knew. I asked three friends, what did your parents do during World War II? And I found that so interesting. So I felt that Steve drew me into this story in a way that I wanted to know more. And I also appreciated the fact that at this time when women were not given any credit, I mean, one family said, yeah, we don't have enough money for you. We're going to pay for your younger brother's education. And this young woman, her name was Marion Toomey, she graduated law school at age 20. Mm. She became Hugh Fulton's personal assistant. But I was impressed by the fact that Truman seemed to have respect for the role that women could play. Other than stenographer, that was a given. He hired this law student at first as a stenographer. And then Shirley Key, another woman who distinguished herself as a stenographer at first in the work with the committee.
You know, books are your world. History sometimes strikes people as dry, but I get the sense from you that this is something you'd recommend to people, even people who don't consider themselves history buffs.
Oh, absolutely. I think people would really be surprised to think, oh, Truman, that was a long time ago. It has nothing to do with us today. But I really think people would enjoy it because it was almost a roller coaster. I would get mad at the waste that occurred and what big corporations did. But then I would be delighted with what this man named Harry Truman did for us.
Nancy Wigman is North State Public Radio's host of Nancy's Bookshelf, discussing Steve Drummond's new book, The Watchdog, How the Truman Committee Battled Corruption and Helped Win World War II. Nancy's Bookshelf is on NSPR, Wednesdays at 10 a.m., Sundays at 8 p.m. Nancy, thanks for being with us this morning.
It was a pleasure, Mike. Thank you.
That's Insight for today. Learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. Subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get the podcasts. And if you want to join the conversation, email us, insight@capradio.org. I'm Mike Haggerty. Vicki's back Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.